This is a paper entitled The Key to the Kingdom. It is taken from the work by Ames Knoll, CSB, DD, entitled Mary Baker Eddy, Her Revelation of Divine Egoism. Everything you have read thus far in this book has been leading up to this moment. The elements of divine science, namely the absolute incontrovertible allness and oneness of God, and the nothingness of anything apart therefrom, have been placed before you for your enlightenment. The ultimate idea of God, as it unfolded to Mary Baker Eddy, has been set forth gently, so that it would not unduly shock human thinking. The fact that Jesus, in his greatest works, spoke as God, even though he was not God, has been stated, thereby exposing to the reader's consciousness that there is a higher and better way of praying than merely to think about God from the standpoint of a mortal. The groundwork has been laid by which thought may be prepared to see and accept divine science. If you have followed along in this unfoldment of the upward way, you now stand before the door of heaven, but you are still on the outside looking in. The final step of entering the mansion or consciousness of God remains to be taken. To this end, as has been brought out in this book, it is imperative that you get out of a human personal eye sense of selfhood in matter, and get into God so far that your consciousness takes on the character of divinity, and so becomes God's consciousness of himself. How can you make this great transition in thought from a human to a divine basis is the problem now to be considered. In other words, the time has come in which to explain the modus operandi whereby to accomplish that spiritualization of thought which leads unerringly and directly to the ascension. The content of this chapter, then, made your own in understanding, is truly the key to the kingdom. It is the ultimate of all things in demonstration. Up to this moment, unless perchance you already have some comprehension of divine subjective knowing, your declarations of truth have been limited to talking about God from the suppositional standpoint of a person who is doing it. To do so is natural, because we, believing in human birth as our origin, have no reason to think otherwise than as mortals. Thereby, unwittingly, we have accepted our death sentence, for birth is death to spirituality. Nevertheless, much has been accomplished through this approach to an understanding of God. By its means, we have seen sin eliminated, disease healed, and many problems of human existence solved harmoniously. In fact, unless we knew how to make use of the prayer of affirmation and denial, the prayer of argument, as it is sometimes called, there would not be enough realization of spiritual reality whereby to rise above human modes to the ultimate method, the scientific way. However, as long as thought remains thus in the vestibule of Christian science and has its seeming origin in the so-called human consciousness, there is one fundamental limitation. One thinks about God as a Christian Scientist who is doing so, and a sense of dualism or two-ness obscures the oneness of true being. That state of mind in which thought is the utterance of truth itself has not been achieved. The final step has not been taken. To gain the kingdom, the altitude of mind, one's conversation or thinking, must be ordered aright, as we read in Psalms. Otherwise, the ascension above all discord into the realm of love has not been made, and so will not be experienced. Illustrative of the difference between the viewpoint of mind and that of mortals are the following two statements. God saith, I am all. The human consciousness, talking about God, declares, God is all. The same spiritual fact is voiced, but the mental attitude in each case is far from being the same. When God has been accepted as one's mind, thought will declare as mind, I, mind, am all. Until this change in viewpoint has been accomplished through actual and effective acceptance of God as mind, the declaration will remain as formerly, God is all. In the former case, divine oneness characterizes thought, it having its source in God, not man. In the latter case, there is a divisive sense, a sense of two-ness, aboutness, or dualism, a sense of being separate from God. While it is far better to know the truth about God than it is to know little concerning the Infinite One, the obviously preferable approach to divine being is to know the truth from the standpoint of truth itself. Therein, the sense of a person doing the knowing vanishes, and God, present as one's mind, one's I or ego, speaks as himself. Such consciousness, being divine, is heavenly. When this state of mind has been attained, the solution of being has been found. On page 314 of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy writes, Our Master gained the solution of being, demonstrating the existence of but one mind, without a second or equal. On the succeeding page, she declares, He, that is Jesus, knew of but one mind, and laid no claim to any other. For this reason, then, we should banish as much as possible human personal I thinking, and permit consciousness to be as though mind were doing the knowing. In brief, we should let God, present as our mind, our ego, or I, voice itself. In this divine way of knowing, which is the manifestation of mind, we find our true oneness with God, our oneness with infinite principle, as its mental action or reflection. But if we permit the carnal mind, claiming to be our thinking capacity, to mesmerize us into evading the issue by falling back on the excuse that truth is too deep for us to understand or to demonstrate, we choose spiritual ignorance for our standpoint. How true it is that when the way is rejected, irrespective of the reasons given, one is mentally dead. The question each should ask of himself is, Am I willing to qualify as a thinker? It's not difficult. If we are to succeed in the demonstration of God's law, I am all, we must be ready to think, to analyze, to sift the chaff of human thinking from the wheat of divine knowing. It should be remembered, however, that no one ever gained the summit of spiritual understanding merely by reading the letter in a book, and it is impossible to coast upward. Consequently, if the reader desires to find the pearl which our leader discovered and hid in her writings, he must familiarize thought with the basic propositions of divine science, and not trample them under the foot of spiritual ignorance or unprogressive human thinking. Your understanding will come of learning how to accept God as your mind, your eye, and of knowing accordingly. It may, for a while, seem as though it is you who are thinking as though you were the Infinite One, but this dual sense will disappear as thought clarifies, personal sense is silenced, and truth is permitted to bear witness to itself as your its consciousness. What are God's thoughts that they may constitute consciousness? Always they are concerning himself and his manifestation or activity. Being all, deity is incapable of knowing anything but himself. Our inspired leader states as much on page 367 of Miscellaneous Writings when she voices this thought: infinite mind knows nothing beyond himself or herself. Therefore, divine utterances express the divine viewpoint. For this reason, then, know out from mind and not up to it. As one of our great and inspired teachers of Christian Science once said to his pupils, be God to the situation. Act like God, mentally of course, and it won't hurt him a bit. This outstanding student knew our leader well, was appointed by her to teach the normal class in the Board of Education of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, and was well acquainted with her teaching relative to accepting God as one's mind, and of knowing even and exactly as mind knows, as I know. Sue Harper Minns, CSD, also understood our leader's own teaching on this same point. In fact, she and Mrs. Eddy were very close to each other in thought, so much so that during Mrs. Eddy's teaching of the class of 1898, of which Mrs. Mims was a member, our leader invited Mrs. Mims to sit beside her on the platform for a while as she taught. No one else, it is said, received this signal recognition. Therefore, when Mrs. Mims wrote her association address to her pupils, and in it explained what Mrs. Eddy had said with respect to the way in which to do instantaneous healing, it is reasonable to believe that she was accurate in her report of this momentous occasion. The author has in his possession a typewritten copy of this address, given to him by one of Mrs. Mims' pupils, a practitioner of long standing, and a former Committee on Publication for the State of Florida, who assured him that it was entirely accurate in every respect. The following comments are based on the teaching as embodied in that typewritten copy of Mrs. Mims' address, especially as it concerns instantaneous healing, and the modus operandi, therefore. The association address just mentioned has been reproduced in a book entitled We Knew Mary Baker Eddy, Second Series. However, a number of changes in the text have been made, a fact which becomes apparent upon comparison of the printed page with the typewritten copy. Most of these minor alterations that do not impair the basic substance of that report, nevertheless, on page 49, line 15 of the aforesaid book, appears a paragraph that deals with Mrs. Eddy's instruction relative to accomplishing as instantaneous healings. And the changes that appear therein are of immense importance, since they completely reverse our leader's teachings on this point, as set forth in the typewritten copy. As the author has complete confidence in the authenticity of the typewritten copy, because it coincides with our leader's writings in Science and Health, and as the differences go to the very root of Mrs. Eddy's revelation, it seems not only appropriate but necessary that we examine them for the purpose of determining what was really intended or what probably is the correct interpretation. Turning to the book first, we find that the word love appears 8 times. In only one instance has it been printed with a capital L. The reminder have been typeset with a lowercase or small l. In the typewritten copy of this address, the capitalization is quite different, since the word love with a small l appears but once, while the word love with a capital L appears 7 times. In only 2 instances is there no difference between the printed version and the typewritten copy. If the reader happens to have a printed copy in his possession, he may, by inserting capital L where indicated, make his book conform to the typewritten copy. Why were these alterations made? Since the Christian Science Board of Directors stated in a letter to the Secretary-Treasurer of the Sue Harper Mims Students Association under date of August 13, 1926, that the copy in their possession, which was doubtless similar to that in the author's possession, included some mistakes, it is probable that, in reproducing Mrs. Mems' address in the book under consideration, they made a number of corrections which they deemed appropriate. According to the revised text of Mrs. Mems' address as it appears in the book We Knew Mary Baker Eddy, we find that it ends with a direction that we must be all love, small l, that is, nothing but love, small l. In response to this instruction, one might quite probably ask, how can one be nothing but love? Or, to take hold of the opposite end of the same stick, how can one be hate? A person may hate somebody, but he is not hate. Neither, then, can one be love, and for the same reason. Webster defines the word love in part as meaning a feeling of strong personal attachment, tender and passionate affection for one of the opposite sex, fondness, goodwill, etc. Nowhere in the author's unabridged edition of Webster's dictionary can one find a spiritual meaning for the word love. It is hardly likely, then, that our leader would have recommended this sort of love as a way whereby to demonstrate instantaneous healing. Doubtless, in substituting love with a small l for love with a big L when changing the copy prior to publication, the Christian Science Board of Directors felt that the word love had the significance of the reflection of love with a capital L, and used it with that sense in mind. But however exalted their concept might have been in making the alteration, it did hide Mrs. Eddy's fundamental teaching, and that is to be regretted. Man just cannot be love. He can be and is the action of love, that is, its loving, but he can never be love. Therefore, let us see what happens when the word love with a capital L is employed as indicated by Mrs. Mims' original writing as set forth in the typewritten copy. To live love, to be it, to be all love, to be nothing but love, involves a complete change in viewpoint from a human to a divine basis. Knowing as love, and thereby being it, is to be all the love there is qualitatively. Thereby, thought is nothing but love, with a capital L. Remember, effect, the act of loving by love, is as much love divinely as is the faculty of loving manifested by love itself, the causative sense. Thus, when love loves, this act of loving is its reflection, or man. And it is one thing, namely infinite love, manifesting itself by loving. To be love, then, let thought rise to oneness with love as its loving. Before such knowing or loving, error flees, and the dead are raised. How far more potent is the teaching as set forth in the typewritten copy? There is no comparison. Had the original text of Mrs. Mim's address been printed, some unalert readers might have leapt to the erroneous conclusion that Mrs. Eddy was advising her students to become or be God. That is always the risk one incurs when making absolute statements of subjective truth, as voiced by deity. But would it not have been better to print our leader's instructions on this vital metaphysical point, and run the slight risk that a few persons might be misled through their own ignorance of truth? Be that as it may, our leader's instruction has now been stated herein for all to read and comprehend, and the essence of her teaching on this important point has been preserved intact, untouched by human hypotheses or reasoning. Verily, verily, as the master was wont to say when introducing some scientific truth, thought must be nothing but love, but truth. This viewpoint must be divine, not human, or the interpretation of being will be mistaken. The invisible principle of the universe must interpret it, as per Science and Health, page 272. And again on page 124 of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy writes, "The universe, like man, is to be interpreted by science from its divine principle God, and can then be understood. But when explained on the basis of physical sense, and represented as subject to growth, maturity, and decay, the universe, like man, is and must continue to be an enigma. Only by viewing existence from the standpoint of principle, and not from the viewpoint of mortal man, can interpretation be scientific and correct. For, as our leader has stated on page 126 of Science and Health, the human mind never produced a real tone, nor sent forth a positive sound." Again, on page 126 of Science and Health, Mary Baker Eddy brings out the error of human interpretation by writing, "All science is divine. Human thought never projected the least portion of true being. Human belief has sought and interpreted in its own way the echo of spirit, and so seems to have reversed it and repeated it materially. But, as previously quoted, the human mind never produced a real tone, nor sent forth a positive sound." By that token, then, that which says I, and is not mind or God, is mortal mind in its seemingly human characteristics. And whatever it says or claims is a reversion of mind and substance with everything turned upside down. Therein we find delusion, confusion, and carnal subtlety, and however good it may seem to be, it is merely error in a more skilful disguise. Only in God may genuine good be found, as per Science and Health, page 301, line 24. How often it is believed that to identify the personal I sense with human goodness is a scientific thing to do. Yet if the I refers to person rather than to principle, it is wrong identification, for it is mortal mind which supposedly speaks. Pointing to the mindless nature of matter or error, and the mistake of thinking in a human way, Mrs. Eddy writes on page 210 of Science and Health, what is termed matter, being unintelligent, cannot say, I suffer, I die, I am sick, or I am unwell. It is mortal mind which speaks thus, and appears to this so-called mind to make good its own claim. While most Christian scientists recognize the error of saying, I suffer, I die, or I am sick, thereby unscientifically identifying man with evil, they are not so quick to detect the error of saying, I am well, if that declaration has its source in the so-called human consciousness. Only if the I goes to the Father and means Father, if it identifies God rather than person, will the statement, I am but well, be scientific and good. Then it is the utterance of the divine mind, and carries with it the understanding of infinite perfection, as well as the power of the healing Christ. Those who feel that there is good in the human consciousness refuse to recognize the teaching of divine science, that there is no other consciousness but God or mind. Actually, any good that appears to be characteristic of anything human, be it mind or consciousness, is entirely suppositional and lacks divine definition, since it, being human, is discolored by a degree of materialism, personality, or finity. Thus, there is therein no genuine good free from any vestige of error. For this, as well as many other reasons, instead of attempting to justify personal sense with its erroneous misconception of I, we should be glad to forsake the seemingly human sense of things and, as our leader has written, gather the facts of being from the immortal divine mind, as per Science and Health, page 370. While some readers may already have perceived how to know divinely and subjectively, that is, how to know as I, many seem to need more specific, detailed instructions on the best way whereby to get rid of or get out of personal I sense of selfhood in matter and get into God. It is to these that the following pages are particularly devoted. In them they will find a method or mode of procedure that will help them to silence personal sense and permit God to speak unhampered by finite thinking. Mary Baker Eddy, to whom the divinely subjective idea of truth had been revealed, furnishes us with an illustration that points the way. Although she does not state categorically that this is the way, her language indicates as much. Those who are familiar with her mode of expression know that she often has recourse to an indirect type of teaching rather than spelling out her thought, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, so to speak. It seems that she was content to let the individual find the way for himself through spiritual growth in understanding. While her method for instruction doubtless protected her from the unwisdom of spiritually backward students, it did tend to hide her revelation from earnest seekers after the ultimate of all things. as she is no longer visible to us in this present state of corporeal existence. There is no longer any necessity for continuing to conceal the message hidden in her language, and it is to be brought out in easily understandable terms right now. Subheading: The Acting Method. The illustration, or one might call it the parable, referred to above, appears on 261 of Science and Health and reads as follows. Under the strong impulse of a desire to perform his part, a noted actor, said to be Edwin Booth, used, night after night, to go upon the stage and sustain his appointed task, walking about as actively as the youngest member of his company. This old man was so lame that he hobbled every day to the theatre and sat aching in his chair till his cue was spoken, a signal which made him as oblivious of physical infirmity as if he had inhaled chloroform, though he was in full possession of his senses. Have you detected the method yet? If not, then read the first sentence in the next paragraph. It should open your eyes, for it reads, "Detach sense from the body or matter, which is only a form of human belief, and you may learn the meaning of God or good, and the nature of the immutable and immortal, breaking away from the mutations of time and sense. You will neither lose the solid objects and ends of life, nor your own identity. Fixing your gaze on the reality supernal, you may rise to the spiritual consciousness of being, even as the bird which has burst from the egg and preens its wings for a skyward flight." How is one to detach sense from the body if thought continues to be the subjective state, or embodiment of the carnal, fleshly human mind, so-called? How is one to put off a personal I sense of selfhood in matter? Obviously, one must break away from the mutations of time and sense by fixing one's mental gaze on the reality supernal. In other words, one must give rise to the spiritual consciousness of being. This great revolution in thought cannot be achieved by personal sense. Like the noted actor, one must get out of the human character called me and into a new part, that of God. Relative to the noted actor, let us assume he was acting the part of Macbeth in Shakespeare's play of the same name. While he sat aching in his chair, he was thinking of himself in a human way, of himself as an actor awaiting his cue. To this darkened sense of corporeal selfhood, he was Edwin Booth, a person suffering from a crippling physical belief. However, when his cue was spoken, he ceased to think as Edwin Booth. He became Macbeth. Consequently, he went on the stage as Macbeth. He spoke as Macbeth. He acted as Macbeth. And as far as his consciousness of himself was concerned, he was Macbeth. Since Macbeth did not suffer from the particular physical disability that plagued Edwin Booth, there was no sense of pain. He had gotten out of himself and into the part that he was portraying so far that his former personal sense of selfhood as an actor had been blotted out of thought. He was a new character, a new man, theatrically speaking. Therefore, his experience took on the character of the part he was acting, so long as he was thinking as Macbeth. But when he stopped doing so, and returned to his former belief that he was Edwin Booth, the pain connected with this belief reasserted itself, and his body or consciousness ached. A well-known actress of our day has been quoted as saying substantially that in order to act convincingly, she must first wipe the mental slate clean. That is, she must be rid of herself as a person and be the part to be acted. When the human sense of self, with its personal problems and thoughts, has been removed, gotten out of the way, and thought is that of the character to be portrayed, the key to successful acting has been found. Then there is no possibility of stage fright. For stage fright is nothing but personal sense asking of itself if it is doing well or badly. Were Christian Scientists to realize that by being divine love in thought, they would soar to the mountaintop of spiritual understanding, they would waste no further time attempting to improve upon the human consciousness, upon that which has no actual existence in science and in truth. Rather, they would detach sense from the body, they would forsake a personal I sense of human being, and take on the character of deity, their real mind or ego, and then gain the kingdom. In the light of the foregoing, one can see what that Christian Science teacher meant when he counseled his pupils to act just like God. It won't hurt him a bit. Needless to say, the only way whereby to act just like God is to know exactly as he does, to work only as God works, as our leader has recommended. To do so is scientifically justified, because God is our mind. Indeed, for divine science to be truly demonstrated, thought must be by mind and as mind. Anything else than that is personal sense or mortal mind. To know as spirit, as I, eliminates personal thinking. For two distinctly different points of view cannot be maintained simultaneously. Either we shall serve God by letting him voice his thoughts in and as individual consciousness, which must be divine, or we shall serve Mammon by continuing to think as mortals. Which part we shall act or be is the choice which every one of us must take. Either we shall accept God as our mind, our real I, and know as this I, or we shall dance to the tune of mortal mind and merit the punishment which inevitably accompanies that mode of thinking which, in its essence, is Antichrist, since it is a tacit denial of God's law, I am all. Which part will you, the reader, choose? There is no danger of losing anything of value by knowing divinely. The personal I self is nothing in and of itself. So to detach oneself from a material body is to gain rather than to lose identity. Man's true identity is unalterably established in the realm of spirit's consciousness. For genuine identity is the reflection of soul or spirit, namely man. Thus there is everything to be gained by permitting thought to ascend to the altitude of mind itself. Only a false sense of human personality is fearful of this change in viewpoint, because it foresees that its own end approaches in proportion to its being put off. That man's identity is unchangeable is clearly indicated by the marginal heading opposite the important paragraph on page 261 of Science and Health, which we have been considering. It is this: the immutable identity of man. Therefore, nothing can be lost by identifying thought with divinity. It is the best thing that may be done, for its outcome is life eternal. Some years ago, there was an interesting play called Green Pastures. The cast was wholly African American, and a great strapping fellow acted the part of God. His portrayal was excellent. While on stage he spoke as God, he acted as though he were God, and he performed his part admirably. During this time, he must have thought as God too, otherwise his acting would not have been so convincing. It mattered not that the type of deity depicted was more human than divine. After all, it was not intended that the play should be an attempt at indoctrinating the audience with a new concept of God. On the contrary, it was meant to be just what it was, a pleasant, happy, and amusing presentation that revealed God as a somewhat distraught personality who had monumental difficulty in making his earthly children act as they should. Despite the flood, lightning bolts that he hurled, and numerous trials which he visited upon them, they persisted in being human, ungodlike. While this play contributed nothing of a spiritual nature to a Christian scientist who saw it, it did leave an indelible mark on his thought, which came to his assistance a number of years later. He had met a practitioner who understood the divinely subjective way of knowing as mind, as the I. She had been a pupil of the teacher previously mentioned, and was acquainted with the way whereby to act just like God. The scientist had many meetings with her while she expounded the divine way, for he was seeking a practical understanding of the ultimate method for scientific demonstration as practiced by the master. However, although he was familiar with the character of God's thoughts and utterances, he could not bring himself to voice them. His human sense of a personal I-self was in the way. He recognized that were a finite sense a human being, speaking from the standpoint of corporeal personality, to say, for example, I am spirit, it would be blasphemous and sacrilegious. Clearly, something had to be done to break down and overthrow this wall of error that was impeding his progress. The question before thought was therefore, how am I to get rid of this false sense called me? All of a sudden he remembered the play Green Pastures. He also remembered the noted actor referred to in the textbook, and recognized that the one who had portrayed God must have thought as God. Consequently, he asked of himself, why shouldn't I do likewise? Jesus did, and he was our exemplar. Upon arriving at this conclusion, the student immediately took steps to simulate deity, to act the part of God, that is to know as though he were mind itself. Sitting on a chair which for the purposes of his playlet was the throne in heaven, he took on the character of the Infinite One. He began to think in a divine way exactly as he believed God would do. There was nothing presumptuous, blasphemous, nor sacrilegious about what he was doing, because his motive was pure. His sole desire was that consciousness should approximate the understanding of mind. Sincerity characterized the whole procedure. As he sat thus, mentally acting the part of God, the suggestion that had interfered with his growth in spiritual perception knocked at the portal of thought, saying as before, I do not understand. immediately and without hesitation, this full sense of I was rejected, together with its claim of spiritual ignorance. And the specific counterfact of truth was voiced from the standpoint of mind itself, namely, I understand. I know all because I know myself. In fact, I am all. I am that I am. My understanding is infinite, all-inclusive, embracing every perfect and divine concept. This protest of scientific truth, by truth, as truth, poured forth effortlessly and naturally. The I went to and meant principle, not person. The actor had ceased to be. It was God who spake, for the personal sense of I had been put off, silenced, thereby permitting spirit to be heard above the din of human disbelief. No longer was it difficult nor improper for the student to know and speak as mind, as the ego, for the method by which to let that mind be in evidence, which was also in Christ Jesus, had been discovered. The way was now clear. For a few times more, the student made use of this little device, whereby to orient thought in the realm of the divine mind. Finally, understanding displaced unfamiliarity, and it was no longer necessary to pretend, to act a part, and recourse to temporary means could be relinquished. Thereafter, having learned, at least in some degree, how to get out of self and into God, he was able to silence sense sufficiently to permit God, mind, to speak in and as consciousness, and so taste heaven, as promised by Mrs. Eddy. If this ultimate method of working as mind, as I, instead of as a Christian scientist, is startling to personal sense, remember that it was Mary Baker Eddy who, understanding what Jesus was doing when he spoke as God, pointed it out in Science and Health in many ways, and affirmed that it was scientific. Thus, in the chapter on recapitulation, upon which class instruction in science is based, she wrote on page 494, Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, body, and in 3 days I, mind, will raise it up." And so he did, for tired humanity's reassurance. As so often occurs in the Christian Science textbook, the paragraph following a profound declaration of scientific truth is used to point up the lesson to be learned. In the present instance, immediately following the previous quotation, she wrote, "Is it not a species of infidelity to believe that so great a work as the Messiah's was done for himself, or for God, who needed no help from Jesus' example to preserve the eternal harmony? But mortals did need this help, and he pointed the way for them." In other words, our leader is telling us that when the Master spoke as God, he was illustrating the correct and scientific method for demonstrating God's law. He was pointing the way. If we doubt the Master's mode for thought, believing that only he was qualified to practice thus, if we question our leader's revelation of divine subjective egoism, or knowing as the ego, or I, we are guilty of a species of infidelity. And whether we like it or not, such doubtful thinking comes perilously close to being anti-Christ. Mrs. Eddy tells us that he did it for tired humanity's reassurance, to show us the way out of personal problems. Would it not be well to make a genuine effort to grasp and hold this pearl of great price. Perhaps the reader may be one of those who sees the light quickly and has no difficulty in accepting God as his mind, as his only eye. In that case, it is not necessary to adopt the playlet method, whereby to silence the corporeal ego and permit God or mind to voice himself freely in and as consciousness. However, if the reader has been helped by these specific instructions, it may be well to continue to work thus until thought rises high enough to make such a method unnecessary. The individual will know when this stage in spiritual growth has been reached, and he can then dispense with this procedure. Returning again to our leader's advice that we work only as God works, it is important to remember that the less involvement of human personality there is in this joyous labor of knowing divinely, the better. Strictly speaking, mortals cannot work as God works. Were this possible, there would be two workers, man and God. The allness and oneness of God precludes dualism. Be that as it may, it seems like two until the we sense of doing something unusual is forsaken in the scientific realization that it is I who speak, and not a person trying to pattern the infinite. It is for this reason that the method whereby to get out of self and into God is so vitally important. Thought must be divinely impersonal, the reflection, the knowing, the mental act of the divine mind, or it will not carry on its wings the healing power of Christ truth. One way whereby to uplift thought to divine heights is to repeat slowly and thoughtfully the words, I am. Say I am over and over again. Let it be divine love that says it. Lift the sense of I higher and higher. Let the I rise to the altitude of divine conception so that it is love that speaks. Be divine love saying it. Shut out the personal sense of I. Knowing thus, impersonally, spiritually, divinely, and subjectively, within one's true self, thought is imbued with love, and consciousness experiences a tremendous awakening to spiritual power, the power to be good, to do good, to accomplish all good. For it will be God doing it in spite of the belief that one may be knowing as the I. There is a letter by our leader which voices substantially the thoughts expressed just now. Therefore, the advice given is truly scientific. As thought dwells in the consciousness of I am, quietude displaces the stir of human thinking, fearing and believing. Knowing as the ego is the divine order. Then, when thought has truly entered the closet of subjective divine consciousness, the utterances may be expanded to, let us say, I am all, I am perfect, I am inclusive good, etc., etc. The counterfacts of truth may be voiced that annul the suggestions of error, not as a person doing it, but as mind, as the ego, speaking of itself and of its infinite self-expression. Could anything be more heavenly, more powerful? No evil can withstand such knowing, for it is God in action. To mentally be divine love in thought unlocks immeasurable good, it heals. Unquestionably, it is man's heaven-bestowed prerogative to put off the old man of human thinking for the new man of divine knowing, and thereby to inherit the kingdom. The language of Spirit God, which is the utterance of mind, and which constitutes consciousness, when the false sense of I has been relinquished, is amply illustrated in both the Bible and in our leader's writings. She leaves us in no doubt how to know if we are to know as God knows. Neither does the prophet Isaiah, who often quoted God directly using the first person singular pronouns. For example, in chapter 57 he writes, "I create the fruit of the lips. Peace, peace to him that is far off, and to him that is near, saith the Lord, and I will hear him." Again, in chapter 52 of the book of Isaiah, we find a deity quoted as saying, "Therefore my people shall know my name. Therefore they shall know in that day that I am he that doth speak. Behold, it is I." Throughout her many writings, Mary Baker Eddy gives us illustrations of the manner in which God speaks. Probably the best of these is to be found on page 252 and 253 of Science and Health. There she writes, "Spirit, bearing opposite testimony, says, 'I am spirit. Man, whose senses are spiritual, is my likeness. He reflects the infinite understanding, for I am infinity. The beauty of holiness, the perfection of being, imperishable glory, all are mine, for I am God. I give immortality to man, for I am truth. I include and impart all bliss, for I am love. I give life without beginning and without end, for I am life. I am supreme and give all, for I am mind. I am the substance of all, because I am that I am.'" And then she commences the next paragraph, as she so often does when bringing out an important metaphysical point, with this arresting statement: "I hope, dear reader, I am leading you into the understanding of your divine rights and heaven-bestowed harmony." What would be that divine right but to know thoughts such as these, God being your mind? It is, and the sooner we awaken from this dream of a personal I-selfhood in matter, and exercise our divine right and prerogative by knowing scientifically as the I or ego God, the sooner will the shackles of finite belief drop away, revealing in their place the utter harmony of pure spiritual consciousness. However, it must never be forgotten that personal sense cannot speak in this divine manner. The mind that says I, but with a little I, must be silenced. Only in this way can thought ascend, even as the Master proved, beyond human recognition and up to the throne or consciousness of God. This kind of knowing is a present possibility. As one of the great teachers of our Christian Science movement once remarked, "There is only one mind, and that is our mind. There is only one life, and that is our life, and there is no other." In demonstrating it, you must claim it, and in claiming it, you must virtually claim it and know and think and even act, not as though you understood mind merely, but as though you were mind, not as though you had merely heard about God, but as though God were your very life, your very thinking capacity. So don't work as if you were doing something inside of you, something in your head, but as though you were up there, up above. Start out with God, "I am, in and as infinite eternal mind. Another great teacher of Christian Science, an outstanding metaphysician, once declared, "Matter can never be annulled from within its own belief, that is, from a material personal sense of I. Matter's obliteration takes place from the understanding of the divine I am all. Therefore, be emphatic in declaring I am all," as we read on page 30 of No and Yes. "Let it be mind declaring and announcing itself. Such a declaration is really more than a declaration. It is self-existence." Any failure of I am all to result speedily in healing may be because there may have been some personal aspect to the way in which the I was used. If so, then specifically deal with this suggestion. I am all is mind's own declaration, proclamation, and propulsion. No matter how much mortal mind, so-called, may try to clothe it in a personal sense. The only thing that can now stand between the reader and the experience of heaven here and now is the so-called human consciousness. Let thought remove the seeming impediment by devoting time to divine, subjective, egoistic, spiritual knowing as I, not as I with a little I, and the joy of work well done will be experienced. A few simple illustrations may prove helpful to those who are taking their first steps along the way. Familiar with the prayer of argument, they know that the counterfacts of truth relative to any problem are required to cure or remove it. The same counterfacts are voiced in the prayer of spiritual illumination. But instead of being the utterance of a so-called human consciousness, they are the ultima of truth or God. Although they assert the same truth, they vary substantially in mode of expression. For example, if error says, "I am sick," truth says, "I am well." If error says, "I can't see," truth says, "I see." If faced with a claim of dishonesty, the human consciousness, so-called, asserts, "Principle is all and manifests only honesty." Truth says, "I, principle, am all, and I manifest only my own integrity and honesty." In other words, the human consciousness talks about God in the third person, singular, whereas the divine mind speaks of, and as itself, in the first person, singular. By converting one's statements of truth from the third person singular into the first person singular, the personal pronouns being only employed to identify God or principle and not person, the divine truth of subjective egoism is being voiced. Strictly speaking, truth never denies anything because it doesn't know error, and so would have no occasion to deny it. However, if it seems advisable to deny the error in treatment, even if the treatment is the subjective utterance of truth by truth, do so. Straining at gnats over some metaphysical point tends to obscure the truth. On page 18 of Unity of Good, line 2, Mrs. Eddy puts a denial in the mouth of God. Therefore, if thought feels a denial of some phase of error is advisable, deny it, even if the denial is couched in the language of spirit. Then return to the absolute truth, as seen from the standpoint of spirit, and let God speak once again. It has been said, and wisely, that for every denial there should be 99 affirmations of truth. But don't get technical over it and count. That would be silly. And now, dear reader, the essence of our leader's great discovery, divine science, has been laid before you. Not only what you do must inherit the kingdom, but how you do it has now been stated. The rest is up to you. The limitations inherent in the size of a book make it impossible to do more than reveal the way and to touch lightly on the modus operandi. For further illumination, class instruction is available. However, every effort should be made to find a teacher who is familiar with the divine way, or there may be disappointment for the student. There is nothing quite so sad as the situation in which some pupils find themselves, namely that of knowing more of truth than their teacher. Regrettably, it is a common experience. We read in Isaiah, "Ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, that I am God, I am all." Let God's law be the testimony of your mental lips, and bear witness to the truth as truth. Thereby omnipotence is made manifest. The middle wall of partition, which is the human consciousness, falls, and we enter the mansion of spiritual understanding. May your progress be rapid and satisfying. End of talk.